Hello and welcome along to another episode of Barclays Corporate Insights. I'm here with Henk Potts.
Good to be with you.
And we're going to talk a little bit about the budget, we're going to talk a bit about Brexit, and we're going to talk probably a lot about the global economy and what's going on in the stock markets. Ian, our normal host for this Economic Outlook, he couldn't be here. He's up in Scotland at the moment. We didn't have a cable that was quite long enough to reach him, unfortunately.
His voice normally carries this far. So
it does.
A shame.
he's got a great voice and we'll miss it, and we'll look forward to having him back again in the new year. So the budget.
Yep.
There was a lot that we knew ahead of the budget. He seemed to have a lot of leaks coming out of the Treasury. I'm sure that was all very deliberate. The biggest thing that we probably knew beforehand was what Theresa May had said at party conference season, that austerity was coming to an end. Let's just have a quick listen to the Chancellor on that.
Now we have reached a defining moment on this long, hard journey, opening a new chapter in our country's economic history, where we can look confidently to the future and set our course for where this remarkable country will go next. Because today, Mr. Deputy Speaker, I can report to the British people that their hard work is paying off and the era of austerity is finally coming to an end.
Now, I thought it was very interesting there that the Chancellor said the era of austerity is coming to an end. It's not necessarily here yet. What were your thoughts? Are we there? Can we see light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, listen, we should remember, of course, the budget is always a balancing act. And the Chancellor had to do that once again during the course of this process. He had to ensure the UK economy against the uncertainties of Britain leaving the European Union. Had to fulfil, as we heard, the Prime Minister's promise to end austerity and invest in the NHS. But also prove to markets that the government is still serious about reducing the country's debt burden as a proportion of the economy. As we know, the Chancellor has been very much helped in terms of that task. The economy's been doing a little bit better than anticipated. The tax take has been rising quite significantly, helped by rising corporation tax. Personal tax has increased quite substantially, helped by the high levels of employment we've been seeing in the UK. Borrowing is lower than was previously projected by the Office for Budget Responsibility. And that was good news for him because it gave him the room to manoeuvre that he was looking for. And what we know is when you look through the headlines, he grabbed that opportunity with both hands to deliver. I think not necessarily a giveaway budget. I thought it was a caretaker budget focused on workers, I thought, rather than businesses. Good news, I think, for drinkers rather than smokers.
Yeah, so talking about that, the OBR said it was the biggest giveaway that they've seen since they were set up in 2010. I suppose that's fair enough because we've been in that era of austerity ever since then. I thought one thing that caught the eye for businesses was probably the biggest new tax that was announced was this digital services tax.
Yep.
And then alongside that, we had this news about a stimulus program for the high street. What are your thoughts around that?
Well, we know the old world high street has been absolutely pummeled by these US technology giants who've come along, they've stolen their businesses and they've been working very hard to try and compete with those, and the Chancellor gave them somewhat of a helping hand with that. So £650 million, number one, of course, reduce the business rate, relief for smaller retailers, but also improving the environment around the high street as well, improving infrastructure, the roads, the parking, and so forth, and that certainly is very much needed. On the other side of coin, you see them fighting back around these big technology companies with this new tax that will affect large companies with an annual revenue of more than £500 million. Now, they're in a difficult position in the UK. This is somewhat of a leading step, it has to be said. One would hope, and there has been talk, that we'll see a broader European initiative to try and deal with such issues. But of course, what we do know is there will be an element of fight back coming through from the United States. Many of these big technology companies, of course, are resident in the US. They've been big beneficiaries of the change that's been taking place, and they'll be hit hard by this tax, not necessarily just from a UK perspective, but if we start to see global coordination around it, then it will have implications for them. But a significant move, I thought, from the Chancellor, trying to protect the UK high street and make it fair in terms of companies that have huge amounts of revenue in the UK, but as we know, pay very little in terms of tax.
Yeah, and a lot of people saying that it's been very cleverly designed to not be a sales tax on online goods. But I did read some of the big companies in the UK, like ASOS, they saw a little bit of a hit to their share price in late trading as that news was coming out. Everything seems to come back to Brexit, though. Will the US, with a trade deal on the horizon, try and kind of persuade the Chancellor and the Prime Minister to rethink this, do you think?
There will be some international pushback on this, as we've just been talking about. But the reality is the world has been changing. The truth is we don't have a tax system here or elsewhere in the world that accounts for the moves that we've seen in terms of technology. I think it's absolutely right, and we know the public are very keen for this, that actually companies that do significant amounts of business in the UK pay the appropriate amount of tax. And I think this goes some ways to trying to address that imbalance that we've been seeing.
Okay, so we've sort of touched on it already. Let's move on into Brexit. I think that this was the reason that we were having this budget on a Monday in October as opposed to a Wednesday in November, was because of there was rumoured to be a crunch EC summit in November, which isn't happening. Theresa May explained to the Commons following the last summit in October that there has been agreement on all sorts of things. So the issue of Gibraltar is apparently agreed, the military bases in Cyprus, the mechanism for any disputes between the two parties in the future. And she reminded us a little bit of what was agreed in phase one around citizens' rights, the financial settlement and the implementation period, and more on that later. But let's just hear from the PM quickly.
Mr Speaker, taking all of this together, 95% of the withdrawal agreement and its protocols are now settled. There is one real sticking point left, but a considerable one, which is how we guarantee that in the unlikely event our future relationship is not in place by the end of the implementation period, there is no return to a hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland.
So that was the Prime Minister speaking to the House of Commons on the 22nd of October. Henk, is a deal nearly done, or is that Irish border just too much of a sticking point?
Well, progress has been made, as you quite rightly alluded to. You go back to phase one and you talk about some of those key elements, and even the implementation programme seems to be agreed. That's sensible by both sides. But there's that famous phrase, of course, nothing is agreed until all is agreed, and the border issue continues to be a major sticking point. And that's become a significant issue, certainly against the backdrop of the political mass that we've got in the aftermath of the general election. So there's still some progress that's required in order to make that happen, to get that through. Then we start to look forward to the withdrawal bill, exactly what it looks like, can it be ratified by the House of Commons, and that process taking place. So it looks like agreement with the EU is getting better. There's still some of the domestic issues to deal with.
And how much room for manoeuvre politically does she have between the DUP, between the opposition and between the Brexiters in her own party?
Huge amount of pressure on her, huge amount of pressure. Some would say actually her weakness is also her strength, because actually who wants to come in and take that job on? Who can facilitate the negotiations in a better way without her leadership? So in some ways you feel, yes, she's under a lot of pressure, but she still appears to be the person who can most likely get a deal done between the UK and the European Union. What we do know is the clock is ticking and the cost of failure is incredibly high. We know a hard Brexit, a disorderly Brexit from the European Union would have significant impact in terms of companies. It would result in tighter restrictions on immigration, trade barriers would come into force, banks would not be able to passport into the European Union, loss of access into things like the European infrastructure system, things like the European payment system. There'd be regulatory restrictions and divergence and a radical change in the way in which companies have to deal with their tax. What does that mean for businesses? Increased cost, increased complexity, a fundamental change in the way in which they do their business. And that is significant. So I think businesses will be watching this incredibly closely to see how close they can get to the deal. Failure would have ramifications, I'd say, not only for the UK economy, but also in terms of businesses.
And that's it, isn't it? I mean, the Chancellor barely mentioned Brexit yesterday in his speech. The only time he did mention it was no deal in the unlikely event of that. We'll be back again in the springtime for another budget.
It shows you exactly where we are. It shows you, yes, they're hoping, they believe that a deal can be done and that will help them achieve some of these measures they've been talking about in terms of the budget. But the reality is there. The clock has certainly been ticking. We move towards that deadline. And of course, if we do see failure to get a deal, deal done. What does that mean in terms of the UK economy? Significant amount of stress. We could see sterling under pressure, maybe falling between 5 and 10%. Inflation you'd expect to pick up dramatically. Some economists have suggested it could rise as much as 3.5% on the back of the weakness of the currency, the imposition of import tariffs. Unemployment, which has been very low at the moment, been helping the UK economy, as we've been talking about, maybe rises above 6%. Consumption starts to come under pressure over the course of the next couple of years. We talk about lower business and household investment. You could argue we may see higher inventory levels, at least in the short term, as companies try to reduce the supply chain risk, but that would be somewhat short-lived. And a significant impact in terms of growth over the course of the next couple of years. We don't think that the UK economy, even under a no-deal example scenario, would fall back into a recession, but only would narrowly avoid that over the course of the next couple of years.
Okay, so, and then, you know, mentioning the Chancellor's speech again, just one last time, he talks about the OBR's forecast growth rates for the next few years, 1.3% this year, 1.6% next year is what I've got down, falling then to 1.4% after that. Is that optimistic? Is that pessimistic?
It looks a little bit optimistic, it has to be said. It's not beyond the realms of possibility, though. These are not fantastic numbers within themselves, we should remember. If you look at Europe, it's got its own problems. We'll be growing at a faster rate than the UK. The United States, as we know, the economy is booming ahead. So compared to that, we're still significantly underperforming. I think when you look in terms of the outlook for the UK economy, I think there still will be some pressure. So think back to the course of this year. Miserable first quarter, impacted from the beast from the East, subdued business investment as a result of Brexit, elevated levels of inflation, which was hitting domestic consumption levels. Second quarter was better. We had that warm weather, of course, the royal wedding, the World Cup. We were feeling much better about the world. We were going into stores and spending money. But as we know, those factors didn't last too long. We're starting to see them come out of the figures as we look through the third quarter. And certainly into the fourth quarter, I think we will see some pressure once again on the UK economy. What we know is manufacturing has been weakening. Car production specifically has been under pressure due to EU emission rules, due to the uncertainty around government policy when it comes to diesel cars, and of course the slowdown in demand that we've been seeing from China. Secured lending conditions have been tightening. There's weaker external demand as well. Not all doom and gloom. Unemployment still remains low. Wages have been rising. We've seen a pickup in productivity, something we haven't been talking about for some time. The relaxation around some of the fiscal rules, things like rising public sector wages, investment in the NHS and beyond that we heard about during the course of the budget will be, of course, supportive of growth. We see UK growth somewhere around 1.3% during the course of this year, 1.4% next year. So somewhat below the figures that we heard from the OBR.
So thinking about that in the context of the wider world and the global markets, we've seen a lot of volatility recently in stock markets. There was a bit of a recovery yesterday led by some of the banking stocks and also reacting to that budget. But overall, October has been the worst month for the FTSE since August 2015. A bad month for markets all around the world. What's driving that?
Well, to think about that, you've got to think about the world in which we're operating. And coming into the beginning of this year, all seemed well with the world. Economists, you'll remember, described it as the Goldilocks economy. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. We're talking about synchronized growth for the first time in many years that wasn't reliant on a single geographical region, industry, or source of demand. There was moderate levels of inflation. There was high levels of employment. There was low energy prices. The forward-looking indicators were positive. Central banks still remained accommodative. But I suppose, a little bit like Goldilocks, many economists forgot about the risks of the bears showing up and disrupting the party. Those bears have been somewhat bigger, somewhat louder than anticipated during the course of this year, and they've come in the form of trade wars, come in the form of rising global tensions around Iran and Syria and Russia, and maybe we add Saudi Arabia to that mix more recently. There's been political and economic challenges coming through in the likes of Turkey and Italy. We know that we've seen rising inflation expectations, particularly in the United States. It's been putting pressure on the central bank. Higher US interest rates, a stronger US dollar, has broad ramifications, of course, for financial markets, particularly, of course, emerging markets. And Brexit continues to be pretty disruptive. So when you look at that, there is a powerful mix of macro uncertainty that's taking place. But I don't think we need to be too pessimistic about the outlook for the global economy. For us, the US economy is absolutely booming at the moment, benefiting from a strong consumer, robust business investment, the fiscal stimulus program that's been put in place. European growth was the strongest in the decade last year at 2.5%. It's been weaker during the course of this year. Saw the impact of the cold weather at the start of the year. Strikes have been very disruptive in Europe as well. There's been supply bottlenecks. Look at private consumption, business investment, been a little bit weaker than anticipated. But we still expect European growth above 2% during the course of this year, somewhere around 1.8% as you look out to next year. Emerging markets, even with all the disruption, even with trade wars and concerns around interest rates and capital outflows from emerging markets, still adding to that global growth environment. China, of course, is slowing down. China still grew a pretty respectable 6.5% during the course of the third quarter. So we put all that together and we tell you, actually, we're still looking at robust growth from the global economy. Still talking about 4% growth this year, 3.8% during the course of next year. So I don't think we need to be too pessimistic. I think the corporate picture still looks very bright. The fundamentals are strong. The earnings season in the US is a very good example of that. Some really good numbers coming through from that perspective. So, of course, there are some risks. There are always some risks. The question we ask ourselves is, are these enough to destabilize the global economy and financial markets? We don't think that's the case. We think the next recession is still on the distant horizon. And actually, when we look at markets, it seems to us what we've actually been seeing is a classic correction in a late cycle economy where we've got a backdrop of rising interest rates.
We've talked a lot about President Trump and his trade wars. We haven't talked too much about this rift between him and the Fed. Some extraordinary comments. I just want to say a couple of them. He said he maybe regrets hiring the chairman of the Fed, Jerome Powell, in the States. He's blaming rising rates from the central bank for some of these stock market sell-offs. He's even used the word loco when he's talked about the central bank. I mean, is he right to be so critical?
Well, what we should remember is that markets value the independence of central banks very dearly. And so any disruption to that process clearly poses a problem. I think the Federal Reserve remains under pressure to continue to hike interest rates. You've got the strong economic backdrop that we've been talking about. You've got the impact of the stimulus programs and specifically, of course, rising inflation expectations. Inflation's been rising. There's very little slack left in terms of the US economy. We know tight labor markets, unemployment down at 3.7%. It's now starting to really push up wages. Wage growth in the US is running around 2.8%. And alongside that, you've got higher energy prices as well. And the Fed, of course, has to react to that. And therefore, we still believe they will continue to hike rates despite perhaps some disruption politically around them and some noise around them. So we still think the Federal Reserve will hike interest rates in December. We think we'll see as many as one per quarter hike during the course of 2019. So we are talking about still the normalization of policy in the United States, getting interest rates back to 3.25%, maybe 3.5% range by the time that we finish next year. And the Federal Reserve want to normalize policy, we should remember. They want some ammunition for the next time there's an economic downturn. So yes, there's some noise politically around that. From time to time, you see that around central banks. I don't think it's going to dissuade them from hiking interest rates.
Okay, final question, and we'll just wrap up with this one. Will a Brexit deal be done before Christmas?
Well, lots of people have been predicting exactly when this deal is going to get done and the process in which that will take. Listen, it's going to come down to the wire, it seems to me. There's still some crucial points to deal with, particularly with that border issue. They've been working hard, talking about increasing the transition period, using technology to try and solve some of those border issues. The sensible element would be to get a deal done to start moving forward in terms of thinking about what the future trading relationship is. So we still believe in our base case scenario, a deal can be done and will be done. The time frame for that looks tight, but we think it will happen before we get to the deadline.
Okay, well, fingers crossed, and we'll sit down again in January, hopefully, and we'll be able to dissect a deal. Let's see how we get on. Henk, thank you very much for your time, as always.
Thank you so much.
Barclays Bank PLC is not liable for the impact of any decisions made based on the information contained or the views expressed. Barclays Bank PLC is authorised by the Prudential Regulation Authority and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. More details, including how you can contact us, are in the description of this podcast.